people here. I'm Paul Cantrell. I'm with the group Minnesotans for Fair Copyright, and together with our U of M counterpart students for Fair Copyright, we've put on a series of talks relating to copyright and the Digital Millennium Copyright Act in particular. And we are always interested in having more people on our mailing list. We're going to be passing some sheets through the audience to where you can sign up on paper. You can also visit our website at faircopyright.org and encourage you to sign up. There's a lot of interesting and important things going on right now. You could use your attention. Here's the sign-up sheet. Look out for it. We are also, of course, running this out of our pockets. We formed more or less spontaneously when Dimitri Skvoronov was arrested this summer. And if you are interested in donating your time or money to helping run future talks or flyerings, protests, advertising, all kinds of projects that would do good things in the world, please sign up on the list, let us know. In particular, right now, there's this Russian programmer, Dmitry Skvoronov, you may have heard of. If you haven't, I encourage you to visit the Electronic Frontier Foundation, EFF.org, and learn more about him. He is in prison right now, and we have a letter going through the audience, which you can sign, addressed to Minnesota senators and representatives about his situation. I encourage you to sign that, take a look at it. And that is all I want to say about our group. Please visit the website and sign up. You are here, of course, to hear Bruce Schneier. He's a pretty cool guy, and he asked me not to say endless things about him before we started, so I'll just say that he is internationally known as an interesting thinker and a good speaker and an expert on technology. He's here to talk to you tonight about broad issues of copyright and digital information, and I'll bring him up. Bruce?
People in the back hear me with this microphone. Someone has to nod.
Not a little bit.
Yeah, you'd think that's easy. Hey, there you go. That works. All right. Batteries in this are low. When this gives out, you're going to know before I will, so please tell me. And actually, if anyone has spare AA batteries, we're going to need them. We can have some physical limitations. You can use it as many times as you want, but only in one place at one time. You know, maybe it says some software. I don't care if you use it on your desktop and then your laptop, but just not at the same time. Right, so you can sort of think of the various things you want to do, but basically they come down to restricting use. I've seen library models, right? I can have a book, I can lend it to you, it's temporarily unusable by me, then you sort of give it back to me and that reverses. So what is the abstract solution to this? There isn't any. Right, abstractly, if I give you a bit, I cannot prevent you from copying it. Period. Right, if I sell you 101, you can write that as many times as you want. Right, if I give you a DVD movie, it's just bigger, it's not different. And so abstractly, there's no solution to this problem. Right, fundamentally, bits are copyable in ways that atoms are not. And no amount of engineering can change this physical reality. Right, that's how bits work. But you know, we're not dealing in abstract, we're dealing in a real problem. The question I ask is there a practical solution to this problem? And is there a solution that's good enough, that'll work most of the time? And is there a solution that'll allow owners of content, whether they're Disney or MGM or Sony, to remain in business with the business model they're in? People in the back, there are a whole lot of seats up here in the center, over here on the side, over there. I mean, if you want to come down, there's lots of seats. I mean, like any security problem, the solution we want is some way to manage risks. Can a provider of content release stuff digitally and manage the risk of it being copied? That's the real question. Okay, so now before I sort of go into, I want to go into first a few case studies of things that have been tried in the past. But this is the terminology we're going to be using. Now, we're talking about digital files. A digital file is anything digital. Doesn't matter if it's a movie, if it's a piece of music, if it's a book, if it's a picture, a cartoon, right? Some collection of bits. Could be a piece of software. Right. And I'm going to talk about copy protection as really any form of this use limitation, regardless of what it is. You know, say general. The user will be whoever is using the file. Right? There's an attacker. Which could be, you know, could be the user, could be somebody else. I mean, this isn't meant to be pejorative. This is what we call the person trying to break the system. He's the attacker. He could be a good guy. I think the attacker's the good guy is in Afghanistan, right? Yeah. And then there's the content owner, right? Which is the entity who owns the digital file up on top. So we've been trying to do this really since the beginning of PCs. Right? In the early 80s, software copy protection was a big deal. Right? The content in this case was a piece of software, a digital file, an executable. And the goal was to stop people like you from making copies. And since the early 80s, we've seen lots and lots of solutions to this problem. And every last one has been broken. Right. Most recently we have Windows XP, which Microsoft touted a really effective copy prevention routine, which was broken in a couple days. At least the first time, because it was broken a bunch of times. This is something we know a lot about. I mean there are people who do this for fun. That anyone's involved in the wares community. You know, being the first one to break a new product, having the best break, the cleanest break. But there's lots of copy protection pieces of hardware and software that put annoying code throughout the file. So, you know, usually it's for big, expensive packages, you know, large graphics programs. The cleanest break, the best break. And there's a good article on the Wired website, and someone about 3-4 years ago wrote about the wares community. Really interesting. But what you learn is these guys are good. These guys are good, and they do this all the time. And they're no match for the people putting in the copy protection routines. Right? Microsoft was broken in a couple days. If it was 10 times better, it would have been broken in 2 weeks. Right? It doesn't actually matter. to say, it's also been around for a while. This has been a problem, I think, since the 70s, mostly in Europe. B-Sky B and different cable channels. Since forever, your European satellite TV broadcasters have been trying to copy protect their broadcast content. Right? The idea is, I want you to buy the decoding box. Right? I want you to buy the channels. And sort of on the other side, there's been a very clever group of European hackers whose goal is to bypass whatever controls, to make their own hardware that can de-scramble cable TV, to take existing hardware and rip out the feature for which you actually have to pay. And there are a couple of good books on this topic. European Scrambling Systems is a book. You can see it, if I get it on Amazon. And the moral here is, it doesn't work. Pretty much every new scheme is broken within a couple of weeks. And this is harder, right, because it's hardware. You know, it's not a software scheme. But there's real money to be made here, so there's a lot of impetus to break it. And a lot of people breaking these things are professionals who will sell you a decoding box for, you know, a one-time fee of a couple hundred dollars, and it's good for life. Or at least until the cable companies change their scheme, which happens pretty regularly. Case study three, this is 2 years ago now, CSS, Content Scrambling System. This was a DVD copy protection scheme, which I think they're called the DVD Consortium, just some industry group of DVD manufacturer owners, came up with this really cool system which would prevent copying of DVDs. And this was, it actually took a couple months to get broken, you know, probably not because someone was working a couple months, probably because it took a couple months to get around to it. It was broken by the Linux community. Not because they wanted to pirate DVDs, because they couldn't get the CCF people to make a Linux-compatible reader. So they went and did it themselves. And this has been an ugly case. There have been some prosecutions. Not against the people who wrote it. I don't actually know who wrote it, but against some people who wrote about it. The high profile case was against 2600 magazine for linking to it. But yeah, here we are again, and this is interesting because there's been actually a lot of money making this. You know, you go back to the forum was broken and you read some of the rhetoric. This is hard to do because the rhetoric goes away once the break happens. You can actually save it. The Windows XP rhetoric is slowing down. It's a red one again. This was totally a really effective scheme. Alright, another case study. This is last year. Stephen King released an ebook. The company was Glass Book, and they were one of the companies saying, we can make books uncopyable. And Stephen King released a full-length book. It was a novella. This was happening in a few days. And, Glass Book went after the copies on the net. Even now, you can find them. You go to Google and type Riding the Bullet. And you can get yourself, you can download yourself a copy. So I wonder, I can go on with these pretty much forever. This is SMDI, SDMI, the Secure Digital Music Initiative. This is a consortium of music content owners that produced a number of schemes. They didn't actually field them. These were ones that were produced, put out there with a little bit of challenge, saying, you know, we challenge you to break these. And, you know, people took the challenge and broke them. Most of the breaks were done in an academic setting. If people have followed the Ed Felton case, this is where this comes from. He broke some of the schemes, and the SDMI tried to prevent him from publishing his work. But that's this. The thing to notice about here is the breaks were done by hobbyists, operating on a shoestring, doing it for fun, not by people who actually had a financial motive. But the Windows XP break was done by I believe it was out of Hong Kong. And someone actually wanted to pirate Windows XP, because someone actually had a real motive for doing it, not just wanting to tweak Microsoft. Okay, so, there are a lot of commonalities in these case studies, but this is something to notice. There are a lot of different attackers, so depending on where we're working, depending on what domain we're working in. And sort of this is in the order from low skill to high skill. Right? There's the average user, right? The average person on the net who might want to make a copy of something because doesn't feel like buying it. There's a power user, probably most people in this room. I mean, people who buy that copy actually know what they're doing. And can download tools and might download the CSS, the protocol break CSS, for example. Get it off our website somewhere and use it. Then there's the hacker. If someone's skilled in the innards of the way computers work and can do more than just download tools, might be able to create tools, or at least tweak tools and modify tools. Certainly understand how they work. And lastly, the professional pirate. Right? The guy who wants to stamp out illegal copies of Windows XP or a DVD. And this is important to keep in mind, because when we have a solution, we're trying to solve against all of these attackers. And one of the things I'm going to point out later, that the attackers are fundamentally very different. And solutions that work against one don't necessarily work against the other. What we're really going to find is that solving against the average user is trivially easy, and solving against professional pirates, impossible. And then, sort of where you fall in the middle depends on what you do. Right. Against the average user, any defense works. Right? You disable the copy button, and the average user can't copy. The copy button makes it great if you disable it. Red sign, do not copy. Oh, I'm not going to copy, it's a red sign. Yeah, you know what, it's basically true. Right? For the average user, anything will work. Now, the average user can't install a piece of software. The average user can't configure something. And also the average user isn't going to subvert a security measure because they're scared to. It might trash their system. I mean, they've been working on Windows. They know not to touch it. Right? So against this type of user, anything will work. And no matter how lame it is. Against the power user, it's harder. There are a lot of really weak schemes that can be defeated by tricks. Power users trade in tricks. So when something comes out and it is broken, they're going to be able to make use of it. Right? If the DCSS program is available, they can download it and they can install it. They can figure out if you're gonna dink with something, how to undink with it. Right. So tricks like having hidden files or making it invisible, just not gonna work here. And a copy actually has to be pretty good to survive a power user. Right. It can't be just a lame idea. It's got to actually work. Against the hacker, you've got a lot more problems, because a hacker will be able to go inside, figure out how it works, and make it work the way he wants. And basically, on a general purpose computer, right, on a computer that you would buy, as opposed to a special purpose computer, as opposed to like a DVD player, which has a CPU inside, it's a computer. But it's a single-use computer. Right? Against a general purpose computer, nothing will work. Right, because the hacker will write the DCSS program, will write the program to strip the registration function off Windows XP. We'll write a program to mirror a hardware dongle and fake it. So, whether it's encryption of serial numbers or hardware devices like dongles, online verification, none of that stuff will survive. Right, watermarking won't. This is where we see all the people making wares, all the people breaking copy protection. This is where they're sitting. Right? Secrecy doesn't work. Keeping how your system is secure secret doesn't work. Works for a while. But, you know, the moral is it works for the while is weeks. It's only a matter of time when someone does the decompilation, the reverse assembly. And a closed system, like a DVD player, is much more secure. Right? So think of what's going on here. The hacker can break the system because he can go in and look at the innards. He could run a debugger. He could run a disassembler. He can write programs that sit around the program he's trying to break and mimic the interactions with the real world. You can't do that on a DVD player because you don't have access to it. And so here, a closed system is much more secure. This is important. Come back to it later. Okay, now we have professional pirates. Professional pirates are much harder than even a hacker. Right? Professional pirate is an adversary who's funded, who has motivation and funding. And you know, if you can stamp out a million copies of Windows XP, I think the street price was like $2.50. That's $2.50, sorry, in Thailand. At Zavrog, like last weekend. If you can stamp out a million of those, you know, you have a pretty strong financial incentive to break the copy protection scheme. Right? Now, here are the people breaking the European satellite programs. Right? They're making a business breaking whatever the protection scheme is. So, yeah. They can actually go after hardware. They can buy devices, and this is what we see in Europe. They can buy devices to reverse engineer chips. Right? To scrape the top layer off, figure out how they work. You know, not only disassemble software, but disassemble hardware. Like, you know, these guys, when they produce a fake copy of Windows for sale in the United States, they reproduce the hologram, the manuals. I mean, it's a good fake. Like, because these are the same people who are making fake Rolex watches and Louis Vuitton handbags. Like, you know, faking hardware is what they did 20 years ago. Software is new. So the hardware part's easy. Now, against this adversary, nothing can work. And basically, there is nothing that can work. You know, there's stuff that the military does which can come close to working. And there's this, back a good 10, 20 years ago, when we were, us and Russia were verifying each other's nuclear tests, we did that by basically putting hardware sensors on each other's soil. And there was a lot of hardware access control and prevention. But you know, this is not consumer hardware. This is in you know, multi-million dollar packages. Have you followed this before? Alright, let's just talk about the individual technologies. Alright, first one is copy protection. I said this before, and I'll say it again. Every copy protection scheme ever invented has been defeated. Right? If someone says, and you see this all the time in the advertising, I have a good copy protection scheme. If they're right, it's the first time in the history of computing. It's just not the way to bet. Maybe they are right, but it's just not very likely. So if you think about what's going on, any copy protection scheme, the software itself, right, this piece of software that is deciding, am I a copy or am I original? And it decides this in any number of ways. You know, back in the 80s, it would check to see if a certain floppy disk was in the drive. Sometimes it would look at places on the floppy that weren't normally accessed. So a disk copy wouldn't copy that particular sector. Sometimes it would look at hardware dongles. Nowadays, I'm about to go out to the internet and say, am I authorized? Right? So the software itself is an autonomous blob trying to make basically a decision. Am I legit? But at some point, that software is going to say yay or nay. Right? And good copy protection software makes that decision in multiple times throughout when the programs run. But at some point, it's going to make that decision. The naive way to break it is you find that jump point and turn a yes into a no, right? A a if true into an if false. And the easiest way to break a copy protection scheme is to change the software so that only copies run. And legitimate software doesn't. Somebody will say, if I have a copy, then don't run. Right, so if I have a copy, then run. Yeah. And a lot of them are trivializing it, but this is basically the way it works. All of the work done at copy prevention involves hiding that decision point, making it hard to find. And breaking copy protection is a matter of finding it. You know, there are also other ways to break copy protection. If you can't find it, you might notice that you have a dongle. This one is querying a dongle or querying a website somewhere. You can write another software that captures that exchange, right, and mimics it. Right. There are also other ways to break copy protection schemes, but this is sort of the basic. A digital file encryption. This is not a common way to deal with content. Because there's a Microsoft scheme that was, what did Beale Screamer break? What was the name of that scheme? DRM, Digital Rights Management. DRM 2, that's right, second generation DRM. Digital Rights Management. Okay, so one of the things that we're going to try to do is we're going to encrypt the file. So you buy a DVD and it comes encrypted. And in order to watch a DVD on your computer, you need the key. And, you know, we'll use lots of strong cryptography and, you know, lots of big key lengths, and it's impossible to break, like millions of years to break. No other literature says this. But yeah, you know, very basically how this works is, there's software in your computer, right, that accepts the encrypted file, accepts the key that you have, that you typed it in, and then decrypts the file. And that doesn't mean sometimes you will match the key with the hardware or match the key with the disk. There's one way to make it so I can't just give you the key and give you a copy of the DVD. Right? I mean, so let's assume that stuff works. So there's this piece of software that accepts the encrypted stream, accepts the key, outputs playing, right, the DVD to the screen and the speakers. So the basic way to attack this is to grab the screen after it's been decrypted, right? You don't have to break the encryption, because you've got a software whose job it is to decrypt. Good example is this Beale Screamer. A lot of breakings of encryption work this way. You just grab the decrypted content and then stream it out to another storage device. Voila, you've got, you know, unencrypted content that you now can copy indefinitely. This basically works. And a lot of the work done in file encryption and digital rights management involves hiding, obfuscating where the decryption happens and where the clear text is. But basically, that's how you break it. Watermarking is another scheme that's used. The idea behind watermarking is to mark the digital file so that I know whose it was. And the number of reasons I might want to do this. I might want to troll the internet and look for my content. So I mark the file copyright. I think Playboy does this, right? Copyright Playboy. So if you're going to steal that content and put it on the net, they're going to send their lawyers after you. You also could mark the digital file of the person who bought it. You know, maybe when you download a movie off the net, it'll be watermarked with your name. That way, if, you know, 1,000 copies appear across the net, the content owner will know who to sue, because it was your file that was distributed. I've seen examples of software trying to enforce copy protection by saying, you know, if this watermark doesn't appear, I won't copy it. Or if this watermark appears, I won't copy it. You know, there's sort of different ways to play this game. Can I do questions at the end?
Explosives are hardware.
Explosives are hardware. This is software. Right. So there are a bunch of ways to do this. I can set up so that maybe I want to make one first generation copies. Here's another thing I might do. I might say you can make a copy, but you can make copies of copies. So the first copy, you lose the watermark, or you gain a watermark. There's a bunch of ways you can play. This also, pretty much anything has been invented has been broken. You know, but by sort of by definition, if you can find the watermark, you can tweak it. And a lot of faults are very simple breaks. Right? But somewhere there is going to be a piece of software that looks for a watermark. And assuming, which means the watermark is there, the watermark is findable. Some of the breaks will degrade the content a bit. But the idea of the watermark is you put it in parts of the content that make no difference. In the part of the music you can't hear. In the part of the video file that's noise. So you can just turn it into other noise. There's a lot of research being done here. This is way harder than a lot of people think. I'm not impressed with the way a lot of this works. And then there's a lot of work in trader tracing. And watermarks will play into this. There are other ways to do it mathematically. And here, like some of the watermarking schemes, the idea is to figure out who is it that originally owned this content that's now been distributed so I know who to sue. But this, besides being hard technically, it's flawed for a whole lot of non-technical reasons. Right? Just because I know who copied, I'm Disney, and there are 2 million illegitimate copies of The Little Mermaid out there, and I'm pissed. And I go to the watermark, and I figure out who to be pissed at. And I'm pissed at this guy. I'm pissed a whole lot of money more than this guy has. Right? And if Catherine was smart, he would have found some vagrant on the street, says, here's 20 bucks, go buy some Little Mermaid, and give it to me. And so now Disney's pissed off with zero assets. Very often, the person you want to sue isn't a legitimate copy owner. It's someone 3 generations away. So even if we can make this scheme work, we're going to have a lot of problems here. All right, I talked about this already. Right? This is worth saying again. Most of this stuff works because we're on a general purpose computer. Right? Go to a specialized embedded CPU in an entertainment product, and it's a lot harder. Right? It's much harder to break Sega cartridges than it is to break software because it's special purpose hardware. And actually, some of the current proposals out there involve turning the computer into specialized hardware. Remember how we broke encryption? We grabbed the decrypted stream at the CPU and siphoned it off to some other storage device. If I can do decryption at the video card, at the speaker board, maybe at the monitor itself, I can no longer do that. But you can't do this with code, of course. Right? Code has to work with the CPU. But with media, you might be able to make this work. Right? Now the flaw is going to be you can always redigitize the output. And actually, if you redigitize it 7 or 8 times and then do some signal cleaning up, and put them all on top of each other and clean up the signal, you can get a really, really good copy. But a bunch of schemes try to do this. So the current industry strategy recognizes some of this, but not others. Some things, but not other things. I believe they know that they can't stop professional pirates. That in the end, stopping professional pirate is the same problem that the physical world has, right? That stopping Rolex watches, stopping fake designer clothing, that professional pirate is going to be dealt with through law enforcement, and there's no other way to do it. They sometimes believe they can stop the hacker. Surely their rhetoric says they can. Did Microsoft actually believe the combination scheme would work? I have trouble believing they did. They certainly spent a lot of time, effort, and money making it work. But mostly the goal of a lot of these companies is to make casual copying more annoying than buying another original. Right? If I can make it more expensive for you to copy a CD than it is to just buy another one that costs $12, that's good enough. Okay, important goal to keep in mind. But a lot of thinking they have came from the record industry, came from the physical world, and the net's difference. Right? I mean, to a first approximation, securing the net's the same as securing the real world, but there's some important differences. And there's some allusions to them, you know, in the examples and in some of the technologies we talked about. Like there's automation, like the ability for one person with expertise to create a tool that anybody can use. You know, very often you will hear the industry say, you know, only really, really, you know, this is secure against almost everybody. Only 30 geniuses in the world can break this. Right? But as soon as one of those geniuses breaks it and writes a piece of software, now anybody can point and click and do it. Right? In hacking community, this is where script kiddies come from. Right? People who can use tools without understanding them. I mean, automation has the ability to propagate skill downward from smarter smart is a bad word. From more knowledgeable to less. There's a problem of action at a distance. You know, the internet has no sense of place, of location. There's no sense of adjacency. So if you have strategies that involve prosecuting, you rapidly run into problems because the person you want to prosecute is not in the country you can prosecute them in. Right now, despite all the work pulling CCS or the Beale Screamer off the net, it's available. Usually from countries that are just, you know, don't care that much. Right? And the third characteristic is technique propagation. Things propagate fast on the net. You know, if I had a sort of a new lock pick, it would propagate slowly through the burglary community. If I have a new hacking tool, it can propagate overnight, over a few days. The characteristics of how new attacks move through the community is much faster. And to me, I mean, this is again, how the net works, how networks work. These are things you can't change. Okay, so now let's just sort of go back and forth in terms of what's gone wrong. Right? Automation affects this problem by this creation of hacking tools. Right? Anybody can now use the Beale Screamer. Anybody can use DCSS. Right? You can't design a copy protection scheme that is secure against almost every hacker. It doesn't work. Right? Because the top 0.001% will defeat the scheme for everybody. So the reaction of the industry over the past couple of years is to invoke the legal system. Right? We've had the Digital Land Cover Act, whose basic goal was to make building these hacking tools illegal. That we can't stop them technically, maybe we can go after them legally. It's been expanded. They've gone after people who write about them. They've threatened academics who are writing research papers. Going after people who are writing articles. This is scary stuff. But the basic notion here is, if we can't stop it technically, we can make it really unpleasant politically, socially, to do it. And that's failed because of this action at a distance. Right? Because in a lot of cases, you can't trace and prosecute the attacker. You might not know who he is even. You might not be able to get at him. Right? You can't stop the information from getting out. You can do a lot to stop it in the small. You can't stop it in the large. But if you think about it, Napster was a company started in one of several countries on the planet. You couldn't stop it. And, you know, eventually somebody will, you know, jurisdiction shop will pick a country just for the purpose of doing this because its laws are good. Because it doesn't respect copyright. You know, it used to be you'd have to, you know, if you fly to Bangkok, you could buy pirated CDs. You could buy pirated software in Hong Kong. Right? On the net, Hong Kong is next door to everybody. And that's a problem. And the industry's been trying to deal with this really by enlisting the world. By and lobbying for these laws in as many countries as possible. You know, we see them in Europe, we see them in other countries in Asia. You know, the idea is, you know, the first approximation, the smart hackers are in countries that are pretty wired. So if we can sort of cover it, someone's going to miss gun. You know, maybe that isn't so bad. You know, if we can get most of it, we'll do much better. This is hard. There are a lot of countries, and they're all definitely very different. You know, even before computers, we've had trouble with a bunch of Asian countries and respecting copyrights. You know, that isn't changing. Right? And then the fact that you can propagate techniques means that it doesn't matter where you are. Right? The tools will spread. And they'll often spread peer-to-peer. I mean, they often won't spread by a central server that you can shut down. They'll spread on news groups. They'll spread from person to person. And there's lots of ways these tools spread in the hacking community and then leaking out to the power users and then in the real computing community. Okay, what would you find is that security systems are fragile. They're secure, but when they break, they're gone. They don't degrade. They're not secure, they're mostly secure. They're secure, and they're not secure. Right, this is what Microsoft learned with XP. Right, the system, the security stopped, but you stopped working, like 2 days after. It's not like it worked most of the time. It just didn't work. And you can now, on the net, download a copy of XP with no copy protection and with no nagging annoyances to sign up a passport and get out there. So the industry action now is to push this into hardware. You know, it hasn't happened yet. There's this SSSCA, which is, you know, studies, sort of not even a bill yet, sort of a trial moving forward. I think Holland is one of these centers behind this. The idea is to push copy protection into every aspect of computer hardware. And the way the law is written, or the bill, like the way this potential law is written, it would be illegal to sell computers without industry-approved copy protection, whatever that actually means. Now, you know, a lot of the evidence has enormous ramifications. Besides, you know, pushing copy protection to speakers and to display monitors, it would push to things like, you know, you couldn't sell a car without copy protection, because it has computers in it. There would be a lot of work. Like, operating systems like Linux could be declared illegal if you read this as it's written. You've been in an industry that's pretty much boxed in. I mean, they don't like all this. And there are sort of more increasingly desperate measures to deal with the problem. In the future, you should expect more counterattack on the part of the media companies. I mean, right now, they're trying to transfer liabilities to third parties. Right? You know, we can't sue the people who are ripping CDs and DVDs. Let's go after the ISPs. But let's find some third party who we can go after. Right? You know, let's make it illegal to download programs that circumvent copyright protections, not just create them. And then let's go after the people who are in charge of the pipes, make sure they don't get downloaded. You know, you take this to its logical extreme. In order to make this work, you have to require all kinds to be registered. And if you set up a computer where copy protection is on the speakers and on a video monitor, and anything that is an illegitimate copy can't be played, your whole movie is going to look at a legitimate copy. Right? Because it's not owned by Disney. It could very easily be a pirated copy of Star Wars. How do you get around that? You require everybody register their content. It's actually not that far-fetched. And then you have to actually make all unprotected playback equipment illegal. Right? Otherwise, you're going to see a brisk black market trade of, you know, pre these rules monitors. Yeah, none of this is happening now, but yeah, to me this is inevitable. If you're going to march down this path, you have to go to the end. Because you stop in the middle and it's not going to work. even if we go down this path forever, right, all digital copy protection schemes can be broken. Now, it really is just a matter of when someone with enough skill decides to do it. Right, maybe it will take a pirate with a profit motive. But as pirates with profit motives have shown, even if being in hardware doesn't make a difference. And once you break it, you can produce automatic software tools to make the breaking easier. Right? And when that happens, you will have pirated digital content. It might be hard to find. Or sort of in the post-Napster world, it can be hard to find stuff. But it's out there if you look for it. And then eventually, access trickles down to average users. Do here. Now this is where I get a lot of, you know, you're anti-copyright. I mean, how could this be true? We have to, you know, we have to protect copyright. And I'm actually sympathetic. I don't feel I'm anti-copyright. I feel I'm just sort of telling you the way the world works. And I wrote this in Cryptogram a few months ago. I said, I sort of feel like a physicist when sort of a bunch of would-be space travelers finally got relativity explained to them. And they look at me and say, but how are we going to get to the stars? I'm really sorry. I don't create that. I can't change the law of physics. And I can't. And nobody else can either. And I believe that real solutions involve making use of the laws of physics. And this is, we need to apply judo here. Right. If we're going to fight it, we're going to fail. If we're going to work with it, we can actually succeed. Unfortunately, this means that some conventional business models won't work, and some other business models might work. But that's actually okay. This has happened in the past. It's just to remind people. Right. So my morals are, don't fight the natural laws. Work with them. Right. Don't try to fundamentally change how computers work. But look for a business model that works on the net. Actually, many people will pay for copyrighted works, even if they don't have to. You know, lots of people, most software now is not sold copy protection. Most people don't violate copyright. And they don't. You know, very often people who steal copyright works wouldn't pay for them anyway. So you're not actually losing a sale. And as I said before, simple schemes are enough to stop the average user. And maybe it's a business model where that's good enough. And there are a bunch of historical examples of business models that do work. You know, think of television. Television is a really interesting business model. Right, the stuff is broadcast. It's going through your bodies right now. Anybody with an antenna can pick it up. Right, the business model is based on, actually, the most people stealing the content. And the more people steal the content, the more they charge the advertisers. Right. Does anyone remember this business model? This one works. But here is a model that doesn't depend on selling individual units. And actually, it does worse if that's selling individual units. If you could somehow give away TVs, you'd be happier. Right? You make it as easy as possible. So this is advertiser-funded. Right? That some third party funds the content because of some self-interest. Right? There is government funding, which works for, you know, any, from in lots of areas, for producing works of art primarily, or good works. Right? It also happens at universities producing research papers. There's public funding. Right, you know, PBS, where, you know, it's sort of like government funding, except they plead for money once a year. This works in lots of areas. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, you suddenly have, Disney go by public funding, but, you know, some of these business models will be useful in some circumstances. Patronage is a funding model. It's sort of like public funding. is actually a real, this is a, was a common business model a bunch of hundred years ago, where people would produce content because one patron paid them. And the content would be publicly available. Are there ways we charge for recency? Your stock data is interesting. You can go and get it on Yahoo for free, but it's 15 minutes late. If you want it on time, you got to pay for it. But interesting scheme, because now I want to protect my content for 15 minutes. What easier? You can pay for an ongoing relationship. Yeah, I think a lot of software is sold not pirated because you want the text support. Like, you could give away the content and charge for the relationship. The Grateful Dead did this, right? They would give away their concert recordings, but charge for live performances. Interesting model. Actually, other rock bands did the patronage model. There have been a number of examples of rock bands saying, we want to produce a CD, we can't afford it, so please give us money. Then we have $3,000, we'll make a record. And a lot of these bands did well by putting their content on that for free. They got a bigger audience. Stephen King did this. There's another book he released, The Plant, where he released a chapter at a time. And he basically said, look, if more than half of you guys pay for it instead of stealing it, I'll keep writing pages. Interesting business model. You could, as Stephen King, say, look, I get $500 per book. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to put up an account, and when I get $500 in it, I'm going to put the book in public domain. I will lose no money. Interesting model. Only someone who's well-known can do it because you're paying for it before you see it. But it is a model that will work. And you can charge for just ancillary things. I like buying CDs so they get the liner notes. If I pirate a CD, I don't get all of the stuff around it. And that stuff has value to me. Software is somewhat similar. Someone could produce a good manual. You tell them to buy the software because they get the manual. Also, we use copy protection schemes. There have been some examples of games where you had to actually look at page 70 in the manual and tell me the third word. That's the way to do copy protection. That is kind of clever, actually. I think I said this right. Like charge of interaction. Yeah, I do this in my own newsletter. I do security newsletter, which comes out once a month. I give it away. When I first did it, I thought about charging for it. But I feel I do better by giving it away. In a lot of ways, it's advertising. There's an example of how that works. So a couple of conclusions. In the real world, in the physical world, commerce is based on scarcity. The model is that atoms can't be copied. That if I have something and I sell it to you, then you have it and I don't have it anymore. That's the way the real world works. The digital world works differently. If I give you something, I also have it. And I can do that infinitely. Trying to overlay the top model on the rule of the bottom model doesn't actually work. It can't work. Because the physics are different. Smarter business models make use of this unlimited distribution model. But they figure out something else to charge for, some other way to make money. Copyright can survive this. Copyright survives everything else. Photocopy machine is going to be the death of copyright. VCR is going to be the death of copyright. They're not. VCR is going to be the death of movies. Everything makes everything else more popular. So this isn't going to be the end of the world. It might be the end of certain business models. it might be the end of large conglomerate intermediaries. You know, think about the notion of publishing. The whole idea of publishing came about when the printing press was invented. Right before the printing press, there was a very tight coupling between the work and the physical instantiation of the work. Right, that in fact, the book was both the paper and the words on it. With the invention of printing, right, they're separated. You can separate the words from how they appeared. And if you were a publisher, you were in a unique position to produce copies efficiently when everyone else didn't have that. So you had that imbalance. What computers are doing effectively is writing that imbalance, which has been around for the past 500 years. Right? Suddenly, now everybody has the same ability that a publisher had. So now it used to be, you know, writing hard, copying hard. Then it became, you know, writing hard, copying easy for some people. Now it's easy, easy for both the publisher and for the person who buys it. So, you know, the world's been here before. It survived. I don't see it dying. But I do think that some business models might. And that's my basic talk. Last slide is a couple of resources if people want to see them. My latest book, and that's the newsletter if anyone wants to subscribe. I will take questions and comments, criticisms, complaints.
Wait.
there was some back and forth about how much it was actually costing the record industry, how much NAFTA costing. You know, and the people who were pro NAFTA had really small numbers, saying, look, this actually helps sales. And people download a couple of tracks, they like it, they buy the CD. The record industry was saying, no, this hurts. There's no data without an agenda behind it, unfortunately. Up there.
Actually, not a question, just a comment. I actually view open source software as the going down the other road, the realization that piracy does help sales. The most pirated piece of software probably still holds the record, Lotus 1-2-3. Lotus became the big giant it was because everyone pirated its software and then said, hey, you want to buy this?
Oh.
And you had this developing, and now you have Red Hat going, download all you want. The more we download, the more we sell.
And they're selling, you know, with the software is free, they're selling a relationship. We'll get you a clean package. We'll get you install. We'll get you tech support. We'll get you manuals. Okay. And we saw that with WordPerfect in the 80s. They encouraged it to be pirated on college campuses because then people would graduate college, go to their first job, and say, you must buy WordPerfect. They actually worked. WordPerfect actually worked a lot that way. Who does that? LexisNexis does that. They give it away to law schools. You know, because they know that when the guy gets to the law firm, he's going to want access, which costs a lot of money.
The one thing you said about it being all the lobbying money that's going to cause these problems, I think that part of the problem will also be that the copyright holders like Disney can exert control over, simply because they have monopoly on the content, can exert control over what the device manufacturers do without actually going through the lobbying process. Because like the DVD region encoding, that wasn't legal, that was just because Disney said that they wouldn't release DVDs at all.
And that's actually a really good point, right? There's a whole lot of other pressure the industry can just bring to bear. And actually, that's a region coding is a perfect example of that. Now, this is sort of a new thing that was invented. You know, usually when you buy a book, you can read anywhere you want. You know, suddenly, now in DVDs, you buy them in the U.S., you can't play them in England. You know, which is, you know, really makes no sense. But yeah, that was done because some key content providers said, we are not going to produce content in your format unless you do this. And because they were big enough, they were able to do that. And Disney has changed a bunch of rules. They've changed, sort of every time the early Mickey Mouse takes for the public domain, they get a copyright law extended. I think it's happened twice already. I think Sonny Bono did it the second time.
Do you have any thoughts about mandatory access licensing of copyright content and how that might affect some of this picture? I mean, because right now, since they can say, you know, no, we don't have to give this to you to run this device, whatever, you know, a lot of these web business models that would normally actually might work, just can't.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of legal ways to affect this. Unfortunately, you know, and he's talking about mandatory licensing, which basically says, with the Congress would say, you will license your content to this format or that format, so that the industry can play pressure games. Again, that's going to be a matter of lobbying. You know, the lobbying dollars on the side of the content owners. I mean, yeah, it'll affect it. A lot of ways to affect this stuff in the non-technical area. And most of the battles we're seeing now are not in the technical area. They're in the legal area. And that's where they're going to continue to play out the next bunch of years. Because that's, you know, that's where you can do a whole lot of things that just are so strange. You know, you can make things, you can declare pi equal to 3. You know, you can do stuff.
How do you see this affecting the academic realm, like the research?
This is bad for research. This has a chilling effect on research. It already has. The Digital Media Copyright Act, because of its prohibiting of reverse engineering and talking about security vulnerabilities, has already led to researchers not doing research. There's been an academic that was threatened if he published his work. There have been academics who have announced results and have said, you know, we're not going to make these public because we're afraid to. The latest release of Linux doesn't contain a whole bunch of security information that was in the previous version, because the people doing it say, you know, we don't want to potentially run afoul of this law. The law is too weird and too annoying. And you know, it is a backwards effect, right? We actually end up with worse security because it's illegal to look. It's very much like the tire industry making Consumer Reports-style testing illegal. You actually end up with worse quality products because now manufacturers can hide behind the law. Right? You can either make your stuff good or make it, you know, illegal to say that it's bad. This has kind of very strong effect on research. It already has. And the question really is how it will play out in the future. We don't know. Because the law, this is another example of a law that was passed for one purpose and being used for other purposes. It's being used as a bludgeon. It's being used much more broadly than the intent was. And that's unfortunate. I mean, you see that in some laws. You know, RICO is an example. The laws that had a lot of unintended consequences. This is another one of those sorts of things. Okay.
Okay, so a question about television broadcast and TiVo. Mm-hmm. Really, for television, commercials, thus feeding the model and the event. Any comments on that?
Yeah, isn't that interesting? You know, in other words, really dumb book, Carl Sagan predicted this. Anybody read the book Contact? He talked about
that
book. No. But I think that was a cool idea. Right? A software that, a hardware device that blanked out commercials. This is actually even better. It pulls them out of time. It makes them not exist. And what is TV is scared of it. You know, because it screws with their business model too. You know, how they're gonna deal with that, I'm not sure. You know, you can deal with product placement. But yeah, that's something to watch because that plays. You have a comment on this?
Yeah. Part of the TiVo trade-off is they record everything you watch and then they sell it.
Okay, there's an example. So you're paying a Faustian bargain. Good, that's a good point.
I don't think the two are necessarily
fit. If you use TiVo for the most part, you have to subscribe to the service to plug in to be able to get the stuff, the program to do it. Might you do that to get the program to do it to put the schedule in? They take your view.
Yeah, you know, it's a tough question, right? What do we do now? Assuming we want to make this get to the bright, shining future as quickly as possible, what we can do, what can we do? I don't know. I mean, in a lot of ways, we're powerless. You know, the problem we have, I mean, this is true for a lot of areas of computer security, is that people who are in favor of civil liberties just don't have the lobbying power. You know, the recording industry tried to sneak a provision into the anti-terrorist legislation to make it legal to hack into your computer looking for content. We can fight the good fight, but I actually believe in the near term we're going to lose the good fight because the dollars aren't on our side. As a scientist, this is tough, right? Science is the search for the truth. Law is the search for consensus. Very, very different. Now, I've been involved in dealing with Congress and lobbying, and it's very surprising. But the goal there is to find consensus. And it's consensus among the parties who have, by throwing money at the issue, proven they have a stake. Now, civil liberties people, do get sort of a free run. we sort of get a free stake. But it's not very common. I mean, if you look at the terrorism legislation, we pretty much lost that completely. And it's a tough one, because we're never going to get that one back. And, unfortunately, in the near term, every battle you win just means you have another battle another year. And every battle you lose forever. It doesn't look good. I'm supposed to be optimistic. Sign your petition. Visit the EFF website, visit the EFF website, visit the CTT website. Very often there are what you can do now. Very often there are specific legislations that need to be influenced. And, you know, writing does have some effect. So it's hard to tell how much.
Join the EFF.
Yeah, you get involved in this. Don't be passive. Because really, if we're passive, it just rolls over us. And we're not even paying attention.
That's
the mailing
list.
Yes.
One observation, the music industry is much larger than the radio industry, but radio has basically a free ride because there's a radio station in every congressperson's district. There is mandatory licensing of music for radio play. So the lesson in terms of political judo is get dispersed and find a way that you can make it known everywhere that it's a problem. You can influence the music industry can afford to put, 100 well-known lobbyists in D.C., but if there are activists who can put, 100 activists in every community, you can have a stronger effect on that.
That's actually a nice point. I didn't know there's mandatory licensing for radio. It's actually a really good point.
Can I actually respond to him?
Not politically, because you're close.
Disney owns about half the radio stations in the city. Clear Cave owns the other outside of basically the NPR station. What's happening is with the removal of the restrictions on how much media concentration can happen that they're becoming the same people. But even before then, a couple of months or a year or so ago, Salon.com had a wonderful series of articles. Viola is alive and well.
Yes, I remember that. That's actually very good. It's a good series. I remember that too.
And basically, the radio stations, even the independent, Clear Cave radio stations, which aren't owned by a major media group, are, they're getting half their money from the major record labels. So,
which is another business model. Yes.
One of the important things to remember is you're never going to win this fight when you fight it on their ground. Your very first slide talks about the owner of digital content information. And what they're playing with there is a very powerful analogy, which is the analogy between the ownership of property, physical property. And you immediately refuted that and said owning this isn't the same thing. But laws are made, lawyers and legislators understand things in terms of such simple-minded analogy. So once they made the analogy and said, I'm an owner, they've won. So what we need to do is to take that away and understand that this is a different media, that it's a different thing from the ownership of the piece of paper.
It's true, it's a lot harder to do. Because then you're really giving up the notion of almost of copyright. I mean, there is a notion enshrined in a whole lot of law of the owner of a work, which is independent from the owner of a physical instantiation of the work.
Well, the analogy worked for a while, and there are some of the things that are valuable there.
And I
want to be identified as the author. If I'm the painter of a painting, I want to be able to protect the way in which it's displayed or disfigured or whatever. I mean, there are a lot of valuable things about copyright that sort of came along with that first rough analogy. But in the end, it breaks down.
Yeah, and that's what we're seeing. I agree. Oh, right there.
There are, in fact, a couple owners' rights to consider here, however. One is the ownership of the work is... that is, the creator has a stake here in the distribution, but there's also the purchaser of the copy. When I buy a book, a CD, a DVD, I've got rights. And that's where the DCSS business got interesting, because in fact the person who came up with the scheme to break it wanted nothing more than to play legally purchased copies on his choice of machine.
There's actually interesting, and something I didn't bring up, this notion of fair use. And there are a group of people who believe that fair use are a specific set of rights. That the rights to fair use are delineated and need to be protected. The media companies have increasingly been taking the position that fair use is anything we couldn't control. Very serious. And that as soon as we can control it, it is no longer fair use. And there's a battle going on in the community here. Is fair use something that, unless you want to put a box around it, or can fair use be crunched as we exert more and more control? And this, like, this region coding, right? Is it fair use for me to play my DVD any place on the planet I want? Or am I really just able to do that because no one's yet figured out how to stop me? Right? They're very, very different ways of thinking about it. And, says, well, I suppose there's something else on your comments, so I'm blanking on it. Give me a second. Oh, well, no comment. This is actually kind of fun. This is the way, like, good classes work. I like this.
There's a pseudo black market going on where people buy United States' own DVD players because it's cheaper to buy those and cheaper to buy the United States DVDs than it is to buy the ones for the zone in England.
And certainly now on Amazon it's easy to buy the U.S. encoding.
I don't think it's a black market. I think there's a legal market in the U.K. in
right, so there are no laws around this region. This is just an industry standard that's voluntarily met. Now, there's a copy protection scheme for music, for CDs, which prevents the CD from playing on in computers, on CD-ROMs, and it's something that is. Many car stereos, car CD players, actually use computer CD players, just because of the way the car works. You should put a computer in rather than an audio component. And so you can buy now a CD, which because of the copy protection that prevents you from using a computer, you can't play it in your car. And so here's an example of, you actually buy something with less functionality. Like the copy protection is decreasing functionality considerably. So there's another example of how this is all getting out of control. In the back.
Given the various copy protection schemes are getting more and more onerous on the consumers, I can't play my CD in my car, I have to be gagged for passport if I would buy XP, which I won't. Getting to the point where consumers are refusing to buy things on the grounds of copy protection being abusive. The question is, do you see a potential political backlash? Do you see, say, a third-party presidential candidate standing up and saying, enough is enough?
I don't vote, but sure.
John Gilmore, a while back, the case where he videotaped his brother's wedding includes copying a videotape he made on his own equipment.
Right.
Because copy protection designed to protect
Prevent bootlegging
of movies, worked against him making a copy of his own.
Yep. And we saw this kind of backlash in software in the 80s. And there was a time in the 80s where every major business software package you bought had copy protection schemes. And companies were just saying, no, we need to make backups, we need to be able, we can't have this. And eventually the industry backed down. You had copy protection left only on games, very high-end specialized software, and also some vertical software. You buy a sort of a major veterinary accounting package. It'll have copy protection.
I saw an interesting threat come up in Congress last year. Unfortunately, nothing came of it, but I'd like to see it. Warren Hatch, apparently a terrible musician who makes albums, was getting up enough with the record industry to threaten introducing legislation for what's called compulsory licensing. This is the way sheet music licensing works, where the copyright holder, the author of the song, has the right to say who makes the first recording, and after that, anybody can make a recording of this music. They just have to pay a standard licensing fee through organizations like ASCAP and BMI.
Right, which explains Weird Al Yankovic's career. Couldn't do that, it wasn't compulsory.
He threatened the RIAA. I don't know why he backed down, but it would be a really interesting model to say the original artist can control who produces the first for sale copy of my music, but after that, anybody can make a copy and sell it, they have to pay me and use the existing license mechanism to be ASCAP and BMI.
That would be terrible.
It would destroy the middleman.
Then you wouldn't have anyone with a good intent to promote artists, because anyone who intends to promote someone else can get by.
No, the artist would. There's some idea in the early days of the internet that the internet would be the death of intermediaries. You wouldn't need newspapers, and you wouldn't need publishers, because everyone can get their own content directly from the source. And what seems to happen is the net means you need intermediaries more. Right? The more there is out there, the more you need someone to say, this is the good stuff. So you wouldn't have promoters in the same way you would otherwise. But you could easily have a promoter that says to the artist, you know, for a cut, I will promote you. So, and as a promoter, I don't care who sells the record, because I'm getting a piece from the artist. The artist might pay me or might not. You could easily have, you know, premium services. Now, really, when you buy the New York Times, the reason you buy the newspapers, you're paying the editor, go out there, find me news that's well-written and I want to read. And that's something worth paying for. And as more stuff is out there, people are going to pay for intermediaries. So, you know, in that example, you might not want to promote an artist, but you could be an intermediary and say, you know, I'm going to send you the music I think is good. And honestly, if that doesn't have my taste, I would pay him considerably to get a steady stream of music that I would like. I would gladly pay for that. And the more content is out there, the more you need editors. Right? Editors are important because they throttle what's good. Editors have a different role in sort of the digital world and the analog world. But they are much more valuable in the digital world. So I think things will change, but they're still going to be working, more or less. I actually can't do this forever, this is kind of fun, but go ahead.
Are there any of the alternative legal jurisdictions, that is, other countries, which have taken a completely different stance on the issue of copyright of digital files?
Not that I know of. You've got the standard, we ignore the problem in countries. Yeah, but
there's no countries who say that, in effect, digital copyright protection doesn't work, cannot work, and we're willing to go along with that.
Not that I know of. It'd be cool to have a kind of like a little, you know, Fredonia out there or something. No, not that I know of. I mean, try Finland. That's probably your best bet. What the media companies want is that you don't want you to have a computer. They want you to have what I call an internet entertainment platform. That's really what they want. If you have one of those, they'd be much happier. Right? Because they can control it a lot more. And a lot of the push has been towards this IEP. How will this affect the worker? You know, the worker actually, most workers don't need a computer either. But they need specialized boxes that do word processing, read spreadsheets, you know, display email. You know, we're almost in the world where computers are...
But can they really check with Sony every time they read their email if it's okay?
A lot of people check with Microsoft every time they read their email. No reason why they can't. I mean, that's right. People check with their email every time they read their email. set up a Sony as a throttle. Microsoft wants that job, so you got to fight with them. You know, how this will play is interesting. I mean, really, the business community is probably the best asset because they want the most. There are groups that need flexibility. Most business computers don't. Average business computer user uses like 4 or 5 programs. And not very well at that. I mean, they're not doing very much. You know, there will always be exceptions, right? The research community will always need computers. Right? Researchers will always have to write software. But that, you know, when, you know, people talk about the post-PC era, we're really already there. Most people don't use their PCs as PCs. Most people don't. Which is interesting. So, I don't know, I'm not that optimistic. But yeah, I mean, that the inflection point is going to be in the business world. Because that's where the power users are. All right, I want to take one more question. That's a good question.
I do.
I can't take your question.
I'm
going to
take somebody else.
All right, I think you'll take somebody else's.
Okay, my question is, are the slides on the web anywhere?
They're not on the web anywhere. They should be on the web somewhere.
Repeat the question.
Are the slides on the web anywhere? You want people to visit your website. Come on, let's see it here.
Well, more than that, we want to get the bits out there. So we would love to put as much of your talk on the web as you'll let us.
Okay, every third slide on the website tomorrow.
Are you planning on sleeping tonight?
And you want to own this?
FairCopyrights.org.
So yeah.
Tomorrow, but
I'll email him when I get home and he'll put the option.
And converting to real HTML?
No, it'll be a PDF.
Actually, I should plug, Bruce was on MPR this morning on the program Future Tense. If you go to M as in Minnesota, PR.org, they have, just go to their search box, type Future Tense. Unfortunately, you have to have Real Player or a Real Cracker to listen to it. But
I think it's not at 11:30 in the night.
End on that.